You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Live from London, you're tuned to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
We got on with it. We've had resignation, nomination, competition and coronation. They haven't even decided what the rules are yet.
Outgoing UK Prime Minister David Cameron delivers his swan song in the British Parliament. We'll look at how to bow out gracefully. Also ahead...
Theresa's a bloody difficult woman, but you and I work for Margaret Thatcher.
The marginally less than discreet British MP Ken Clark describing incoming Prime Minister Theresa May. She says the next person to discover just how difficult she is will be Jean-Claude Juncker. Should he be worried? Plus, John Kerry touches down in Russia, and we look ahead to tonight's special live edition of The Entrepreneurs. That's all to come on Midori House, live from London with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College in London, and the writer and broadcaster and Russia analyst Stephen Diel. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us, as ever. Now, it's not every day that the British Prime Minister holds up a picture of himself with the Downing Street cat as proof of his legacy, but while relations with Larry the Chief Mouser might be purring along fine... Speaking of fines, one for the scriptwriter there. David Cameron leaves his post as Britain confronts a period of great uncertainty. The outgoing leader faced his final PMQs today, concluding that people come to politics with a huge passion for the issues they care about. It can be tough, he said, with UK politics challenging its leaders perhaps more than other countries, but it's something we should be proud of. Stephen Diel, David Cameron will be surely remembered for... Brexit, one imagines, rather than anything else. But did you think he managed to bow out gracefully for all of that?
He bowed out with humour, which I think is about as good as it can get. because, as you say, he is going to be remembered as the man who took us out of the EU. And why did he take us out of the EU? Because he decided to hold a referendum in a country which is not used to having them. We've only ever had 300 of years of parliamentary democracy. And he did that really to try and sort out the Eurosceptics in his own party. And he thought, this is a foregone conclusion. People will vote to stay in, and then I'll have sorted out the Eurosceptics and we'll carry on. And suddenly he got a slap in the face, and the country has had a great kick up the backside.
Well, indeed. And it struck me as interesting, Cathy, today that David Cameron said, very pointedly, nothing is impossible if you put your mind to it, which somewhat prompts the question, did he not put his mind to the referendum?
Where was it when it was time for the referendum, yes.
And do you think that is the inescapable truth as Stephen describes it? You know, this is the judgment on what... you know, Cameron's legacy will be.
Well, it's a problem. And you look back, we historians do that. Look at Neville Chamberlain and Anthony Eden and, shall we say, David Cameron. And what they've all done when there is a concern of national and indeed international importance, vital importance, they failed. And for all of them, it doesn't matter if Neville Chamberlain's welfare reforms, it doesn't matter what Anthony Eden did, a bit more difficult on that one, of course, to think of something else. But Cameron, I mean, he's not been a bad prime minister. But yes, I agree with Stephen. That's what he's going to be remembered for, and it's a bit sad.
It's like that, whether, you know, in politics, in sport, whatever. We've just finished Euro 2016, another disaster for the England football team. Alf Ramsey was the England football manager when England won the World Cup in 1966. He made a few mistakes along the way, and some people say he should have played Jimmy Greaves and so on. But why do we remember Alf Ramsey 50 years later? Because he won the World Cup for England. That's life. If you've done something big, be it good or bad, that's what you're remembered by.
Cathy, it's interesting. You mentioned your historian's perspective. Are historians an unforgiving bunch then, or are they just realists?
Well, historians... this is bad. I require notice of that question. obviously, we have strong ideas because we've assessed other leaders. On the other hand, no one is ever dead appalling unless you think of Hitler, I suppose. Mm. But nothing became Cameron so well as his leaving of it. And can I say I was just thinking about this, what my favorite appalling person was in terms of leaving within our lifetime, as it were, at least mine, perhaps not yours. And that was, do you remember Richard Nixon?
I do. I do have.
And of course, we all know he was defeated by John F. Kennedy in 1960. He then went and ran for governor in California. And in 62, when he was defeated, I remember him coming up to the mic and saying, well, you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore, and which was not seen as the most gracious way to confront a defeat. Mind you, 1968, of course, he then became president, so it didn't do him any lasting damage, except in my mind, of course.
Well, except also, it didn't do him lasting damage, but what do we remember Nixon for? We remember Nixon for Watergate, the way he was kicked out and had to resign and, was embarrassed in front of the whole country. He lied, and that, you know, you mentioned Nixon, and as someone who also lived through those times, that, immediately you said Nixon, I thought Watergate.
It's an inescapable legacy, I guess. Well, I mean, it throws up an interesting question, I suppose, which is how do you gauge a legacy, and can you do it on the day that somebody's literally packing their belongings and driving out of Downing Street? Stephen, do you think it is too soon to try and gauge what somebody's legacy is, or
no,
are we dealing with inescapable facts, essentially?
Yeah, no, if we're talking about Cameron, I think that is the biggest thing, because whatever happens in the years ahead with Britain not being in the EU, he will be seen as the man who chose to have a referendum when he didn't have to, and lost. And so, you know, that is his legacy. There will, of course, be books written, and historians will write learned tomes which will point out other things. Actually, I don't want to be totally negative about him, but the other thing that sticks in my mind, I remember thinking that he'd gone down in my estimation going back 5 years when there were riots in London in 2011, sparked off by a guy being shot in North London, and they spread throughout the country, and it was summer madness and one thing and another. And I remember thinking that he took 2 days to come back. He was on holiday and he took 2 days to come back. And I thought he's either got bad advisors or he doesn't get it. Mm. This is just a personal view. That's another thing that sticks in my mind with him. A positive point. I was talking to someone the other day who was saying, well, he's done a great deal for Holocaust education in this country, which he has. I'll give him credit for that. And he's made sure that British school children are taught about the Holocaust and the horrors of the Holocaust and why it should never happen again. And he does have a great role in that, and all credit to him for that. But in popular memory, it's going to come down, even if it's on the day, in a month's time, 6 months, in a year's time, anyone looking back in history, rather like my knee-jerk reaction to Nixon was Watergate, the knee-jerk reaction to Cameron will be Brexit.
Presumably predicated on the basis that we do end up severing our ties with the EU. And who knows whether that happens. Maybe that might change it somewhat, but we shall have to wait and see about that. Cathy, just on the comparisons with how we go about, the technique of replacing our leaders, obviously looking at the US at the moment, the kind of almost never-ending presidential race that goes on. Even in the US, once the result is returned in November, it's, there's 2.5 months or so for the people to get the movers in and get accustomed to the idea that this is the next step in their life. It's extraordinary in this country the pace these things happen. On Monday morning, Theresa May, is busy planning, a couple of months campaign to try and get the leadership. She's running the country by Wednesday. I mean, that's rather remarkable, if nothing else.
Well, it's just as well she knows her way to the cabinet room. the number of people one can think of who who've never actually had any experience either as an elected, as a politician or whatever. Let's think Donald Trump.
Let's not think that if we can.
Not tonight. Yeah. Oh, quite fun to think of Donald Trump.
But it is. I mean, it's extraordinary that you can have pace of transition.
Though. Yeah, but remember that. I mean, first of all, the U.S. has got this rigid constitution. Secondly, England is only one third the size of California. When we first started, when the Americans first started having presidents back in the late 18th century, getting from, shall we say, from New York to Washington, or in those cases, Philadelphia, in the snow, was a bit difficult. So it wasn't just Americans deciding to dally and think about these things. It was geography as much as anything. At least they've moved it back from March to January. I feel I should point this out.
Oh, I always thought that long gap was for, more of an appreciation of home furnishings and that sort of thing. But sadly,
well, I'm glad to have set you straight on that one.
Well, David Cameron has an advantage in one sense. He's had 2 whole days to do this. Had he been voted out last year, If his party had lost the election, I mean, literally, you know, we've seen cases where, for some historical reason, we have our elections on a Thursday, and if the party that was in power loses, then the Prime Minister is throwing his things into packing boxes and everything on Friday to be out by Friday evening for the next guy or woman to move in. So he's had two whole days. So that's longer than
going. Just on the sort of the tenor, the tone that Cameron struck today, obviously in the Commons, we've mentioned it and we played a clip in the introduction to the programme. There was lots of jocularity. He threw a few quite pointed barbs in Jeremy Corbyn's direction. If we compare the kind of language, the rhetoric you saw, Kathleen, from David Cameron today, and we compare it with, I don't know, Gordon Brown's farewell speech, or what we saw from, you know, Bill Clinton when he left office, do you think there is a bit of a playbook, you know, how to be the statesman? Or do you think that it is just people judging the mood, and that Cameron really couldn't do that given these complex circumstances that we're describing? He couldn't really paint himself as this great noble statesman because he's fallen, you know, victim to a crisis of his own making.
But one doesn't in Great Britain. You know, that's not the done thing. Like you don't do gods. You don't do self congratulation when you leave. You don't exactly say, "I hope my mother recognizes me when I get home." But I mean, what Cameron did to what, you know, the extent that I was able to read and to watch and listen to it today, it was light. It was humorous. There were some substantial points. It was witty. Now, you can call Gordon Brown a lot of things. Witty doesn't leap to mind. And Clinton has his own style that people really like. He's a natural politician. But, you know, there's a lot of things to be said for the way Cameron left it. He left it. People enjoyed it. People thought it was a good thing. He left in a cloud of approbation and applause and good feeling. And now he's going to go, and no one's going to ever watch him again for a while. But what will be remembered on, at least for today, is how well he left.
Let's move on and talk a little bit more about the aftermath of this Brexit vote, which has caused all of this. The tension simmered, resignations flowed subsequently, as it became rather clear that, well, no one really won after the Brexit vote. Despite calls to step down, European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker is persevering too, and so for now is the Union. Theresa May, who we have already mentioned, has promised to show Juncker this what a bloody difficult woman she can be, as described by Ken Clark, not my words, of course. But let's think about it. The EU agenda, you know, unity, Stephen, solidarity is there. These negotiations are going to be a tough call, you know, all round. I wonder about the calls of congratulations that will come Theresa May's way. It's obviously very much the done thing. She'll get a call, presumably, from Frau Merkel, from President Hollande, and so on. It'd be fun to be a fly on the wall of those. What do you think those conversations will be like?
It would be fun to be a fly on the wall or tap on the telephone line. I think that there will be a sense of relief, actually, from many of the European leaders, because if they think about it, they might be thinking, good grief, we could have had Boris Johnson, or even worse, we could have had Michael Gove, who not only were they both Brexiteers, but they're both unusual characters.
Very diplomatically put.
Theresa May... it seems that you get what you see. She's comes across as a very sensible, very intelligent woman who voted to remain in, has now got to carry the can of conducting negotiations to go out. But I would have thought that Merkel, Hollande and others, indeed even Juncker, will think, I can have intelligent, sensible conversations with this woman. She has an agenda now to fulfil. It's someone that, to quote from Mrs. Thatcher when talking about Gorbachev in 1984, you know, they may say, I like Mrs. May, we can do business with her.
Kathy, do you go along with that?
Well, yes. I also want to point out they don't know what they're getting. I mean, because she said very little during the referendum. They know she voted leave, but they don't know what she really thinks about all sorts
remain.
Of things. That's what I mean. She voted remain. Yeah. Sorry. Of course I knew that. In fact, I did. But the point is that she hasn't made, since she kept such a low profile, they don't know what she thinks about all sorts of things. They know she wants to restrain immigration. But they don't really know what she thinks about the others. So it's going to be slightly difficult for them to plan an attack or even a defense. So in that sense, she's got all to play for. She can be flexible. She can maneuver. and they won't necessarily know just which direction she's going to take.
If we look at Juncker in particular, it's interesting, Stephen, you're seeing now some commentary. He was under quite a great deal of pressure in the immediate aftermath, but some suggestions that he's been very politically astute, as would befit someone in his position and having done the jobs he's done. Do you think he's handled this rather well? Has he played a bit of a political blinder? Or, again, do we need to wait for the dust to settle before we can come to that conclusion?
I think we probably, to come to a final conclusion, you need to wait for the dust to settle. But I think he has. I mean, if you think on the morning of the 24th of June, when we found out the result of the British referendum, you know, you had people like Marine Le Pen in France saying, you know, this is wonderful, and you could almost hear across the Channel the creaks in the European Union, and I hope. I mean, I voted Remain, as many of my countrymen did, actually, I think there was a. There is still a fear that I would hate to see our departure from the European Union break the Union up. Mm. One of my main reasons for saying we should remain is because it's far better to have a seat round the table and to keep talking. It's when countries and people stop talking that trouble can arise. And there's been an unprecedented period of peace in Europe, which within Europe, I think the EU has played a big role in that. So I think that any cracks in the EU are only bad news for the ultimate security of Europe.
You think one difficulty is that people don't know their history. I mean, generations have grown up not knowing about the war, any wars. The fact that there was 70 years of pretty solid wars of some respects or another, you know, from the invasion of France the first time in 1870, and then two more. And they take peace for granted and don't really have a sense of the point of Europe was to contain Germany and balance it with France. Now, Germany is now becoming overwhelmingly powerful again. I don't think she's going to start you know, goose-stepping into France again. But the point is, there has been a balance, and people have taken this for granted, and Britain leaving is going to upset that balance.
Well, on that point about Frau Merkel and how important she is there a case then, Kathleen, that in fact Theresa May's putative relationship with Merkel is more important than that with Juncker, or arguably with anybody else in Europe? And actually, it will be whether those two can get along, whether they can find an accord that will shape how successful this period is, or rather, that will shape how effective the damage limitation exercise is for both the bloc and for Britain.
I think that's very true. I think Juncker is of minimal importance in this. Merkel, apparently, by all accounts, doesn't think he's all that good either. Merkel and May, what do I know? But they seem quite the same, and not the same. They seem similar in that they're thoughtful. They're highly intelligent. They have agendas, which they don't impose. They're able to negotiate. They're able to come. Let us reason together, as Lyndon Johnson said. And I think that if they can get on, so that they know the other isn't going to stab them in the back, I think that's going to be very important. And because Germany needs Britain, not as much as Britain, well, you see what I mean, I think they're going to do what they can.
I mean, that's an interesting point, Stephen, that Cathy makes there. Is Theresa May, is she actually kind of more like a CDU politician? She's rather than, say, a Thatcherite Tory. Is there actually maybe a closer alliance there along, I don't know what you'd call it, almost ideological lines, perhaps, than on their roles as leaders of their respective nations?
Yeah, whether it's ideological or, and as Cathy's already pointed out, there's an awful lot about Theresa May we don't know as yet, but she does come across rather like Angela Merkel as a sensible, solid. I mean, I realised only in recent years that I'm actually quite a strong feminist, and I think having sensible, intelligent women at the top is a really good thing. And I think gender does play a role here. And I think those two, because they're both women, I think actually that will help too. And women often are better listeners than men. They don't tend to bang the table. There we had Margaret Thatcher, maybe an exception, but I don't think Theresa May is a new Margaret Thatcher. And I see hope there. I'm in this position now of. I tend to be optimistic by nature, but there's
that's
been a
good.
Lot
that's
of,
what we like here at Midori House.
Well, there's been a lot good. In recent weeks that have really tested my optimism. But so when we realised that Cameron was stepping down, and I immediately said, well, the only person I can see that should fill his shoes is Theresa May, and then talk of Boris Johnson or Michael Gove or others, even Andrew Leadsom. I was not encouraged by that, but you know, it is Theresa May, and I think both for our country and for the relationship, and there's going to be a relationship with Europe, whatever happens, I think it is good news.
I mean, it's one good, that's a good point that Steve makes, in fact, because what leaders, and let's hope it's also going to include Hillary Clinton in due course, won't that be fun, all three of them, is they do not tend to draw a line in the sand and say, step over here and I'll hit you. You know, there's the thing is that you've when you negotiate, you have to leave room for both two things. One, both sides have to feel they're gaining something. It can't be zero sum. The Americans don't always keep this in mind. And second, you've got to have room for each to retreat without loss of face. And I'm pretty sure that Merkel and May will do that, in fact, which is rather good. So if we move to talking about Kerry and Putin, we will have to keep that in mind.
Well, that's a perfect time to jump forward and talk about that. John Kerry does indeed touch down in Moscow tomorrow for a meeting with Russia's president. The US Secretary of State will be discussing the ongoing situations in Ukraine and Syria. But could an intelligence sharing agreement also be on the cards? This is one of the most interesting questions. The US Defense Secretary Ash Carter is opposed to the idea that nations could share intelligence and targeting data for Syrian airstrikes and so on. Certain officials claim he has profound doubts about Russia's ability to be trusted, in essence. So, Stephen, you know some of these machinations as well as anybody. How likely is Kerry's meeting, this particular meeting, to change things on that front?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think I wouldn't trust the Russians. I'm literally, now ever since what they've done in Ukraine, you can't trust them. They have a completely different rule book. And I try to believe that Kerry is not going into this naively. I mean, he's met Putin on a number of occasions. I'm a great believer, as I've already said, in dialogue. And I think the fact they are talking is good. And talking about Syria is one thing. But we've seen what the Russians have been doing in Syria. They've said one thing and done another. They say they're going after Daesh, IS, and they've hit other groups, not, it seems, by chance. So if I were an American negotiator, I would be very much whispering in Kerry's ear, don't trust this man, don't say we're going to share all our intelligence, because I don't think what you're going to get back is going to be commensurate to what we could give them.
And Kathleen, in the bigger picture, I suppose, Kerry is an able politician, a capable man, but he is Secretary of State again in the sort of last year. Is it, as we've seen with the President of the United States trying to get things done, he's branded a lame duck and so on, is the Secretary of Stateship a difficult thing to negotiate as we tick down towards a November election?
It would be more difficult to negotiate if they thought Hillary Clinton wasn't going to win, because they're on the same side of the spectrum. She doesn't trust them either. I mean, one thing that's interesting, and Steve probably has thoughts on this, we can't forget the rise of China in the background. Now, what does Russia think about this? In other words, would they be rather keener to have some sort of relationship with the United States as a backup against China, and vice versa?
Well, of course, what Russia has done in the since they lost what friends they had after the invasion of Ukraine, is they've tried to cozy up to China. And I think that masks an awful lot of mistrust on both sides. I don't think the Russians have ever trusted the Chinese. I mean, I remember Gorbachev going there in 1989, which was a breakthrough because, of course, there'd been no relations since the split of the
62,
two communist powers,
yes.
In 62. Yeah, and he went there in 89, and they. I remember seeing how the Soviet Union, Soviet media played this up and said how wonderful it was, and just feeling that reading in between the lines that there was still this mistrust, and they still do, and. To give you one concrete example, you know, last year when Putin went to China and came back saying, you know, we've got a great deal, you know, we're going to sell the Chinese our oil, when the analysts actually looked at it, they find it's going to cost them money to send them to sell them the oil. The Chinese, they know on which side their bread is buttered, and they kept them negotiating until into the early hours of the morning. So because they knew that Putin had to go back saying he'd got something, and the deal he got was actually entirely in Chinese favour. And so I think that, you know, there is an awful lot of mistrust, and in that sense, you know, Putin is caught between a rock and a hard place. The Americans are very wary of him at the moment. I don't think the Americans are too worried about pushing him towards China, because I don't think he'll go that far, because he can see that the Chinese have already done him down once on this oil deal. They'll do him down on other things if he tries to get too close.
So, Catherine, I guess as a final thought on this, should we just be grateful that to a degree it remains politically expedient for Putin to meet with Kerry and to maintain a dialogue with the US, and we should draw some consolation just from the fact that that still makes sense for him strategically at the moment?
That's a very good point. In other words, it's always better to talk than to shoot. That's true. What the question here is, how much is Syria involved in this? That is to say, is the overarching thing to talk together, or is it actually to get something sorted out of Syria? And there, I suspect we will look in vain.
Stephen, a final word then. What should we expect from this meeting? Just that they have an interesting bit of, you know, conversation, and they, you know, do the handshakes, and it's all smiles. Is that about?
Well, I mean, they've said in advance, we're not telling exactly what our agenda is or what the contents are. And I think what we're going to find is that they will come away and say, you know, we've been talking, and we're going to keep on talking. And I would expect little concrete to come out of it.
Oh, I see. I knew you couldn't retain that optimism right to the end of the show. Stephen Diel and Kathleen Burke, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
From New York
to Sydney,
Tokyo から Amsterdam,
London より Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Olindain dama Monocle Pedrarhigain.
Lisboa to Hong Kong,
depuis Londres.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Also coming up live at the top of the hour, Monocle 24's business programme, The Entrepreneurs, a very special live edition tonight. Tickets are sold out, but you can still join in the proceedings by tuning in, of course, to Monocle 24. Let's get a little taster about what is in store. The programme's regular host, Daniel Giacopelli, and Monocle's editor and the co-host tonight, Andrew Tuck, are both here. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Thank you.
Andrew, it's quite exciting, isn't it? We were sat in these very seats, I don't know, a few weeks ago, and we were looking forward to the first of our live specials, which was The Urbanist, your programme, and a great success it was. It kind of adds a different level, doesn't it, to the programmes, a new dimension, having an audience here and inviting people into Midori House to take part.
I've got a few nerves, getting tingly.
A bit jittery.
No, it's going to be exciting. We have four amazing panellists who are from the world of entrepreneurship, people who run their own businesses, people who give advice in that world, and people have gone from kind of zero to hero. So we're going to be hearing their stories. And it's interesting for me tonight also, because it's like Wallace and Gromit. I'm in the sidecar tonight.
I was going to ask
poofling along.
I'm in the main car
along next to Mr. Danny Giacopelli.
And Daniel, tell us, because obviously regular listeners to The Entrepreneurs know that the show focuses on entrepreneurship. It's very much about, you know, a can-do attitude, great inspiring stories. And presumably we'll dip into that tonight. But presumably we won't shy away from, you know, some of the more challenging and immediate questions that are out there.
Are you referring to Brexit, Tom?
Well, that raises its ugly head. We've been talking about it on Midori House.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that. I mean, each of the people tonight kind of have a stake in what happens in the future of Britain. Obviously, David, who runs the Grind group of cafes around London, he started out in Shoreditch, which is the heart of the creative and tech industry in London. If people stop making startups, he's not going to have people who want flat whites. I mean, and so on and so on. So, I mean, everybody has a personal stake. Jeff Mogens, the CEO of Nesta, the innovation group, they've done tons of research into these innovation hubs in cities around the world. And, you know, Brexit, as it were, will surely have an impact on the creative output of London.
But we're going to leave people with a positive note today. That's the key thing. You know, all these people have faced challenges and got past them. That's why they're successful. And we want to hear about their strategies for coping, with some more kind of hurdles ahead, but really how they keep their eye on what the key ambition is.
Wonderful stuff. Well, you can hear Andrew and Danny with their guests, who they've been mentioning there, at the top of the next hour, 1900 here in London, right after the news. That's a special Live Entrepreneurs on the Way. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House, though. Today's programme was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Barclay Bram, and our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. My thanks to them all. Don't forget more news and views on the daily at 2200, and Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 here in London. Thanks for tuning in. Goodbye.